and I'm handing the keys over, and I'm like, why is everyone staring at me? And then I realize that I am covered in, like, a layer of the night's party scum. I have fucking glitter all over my forehead, and I smell like a distillery.
Yo, sucker, you got a big mouth.
I'm hard like bread, man. Tripping with a type of acid in my headband.
About to lose my mind.
The name's Page One, I'll kick that ass quickly. When I die, I'ma try to take the whole world with me. Four rhymes penetrate the kidney. When I die, I'ma try to take the whole world with me.
I got plans to lock it down.
Take it with me. Take it with me.
Yeah.
The whole world. I'll be hitting you.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 6 of the Mr. Baby Podcast. This week we have our guest Nate, who came in to tell us some of the stories from his dodgy past and some other entertaining ones from traveling abroad. After the fact, we discovered some of these things might have to be edited, so enjoy these stories about guns, drugs, and a whole lot of raving.
When I die, I'ma try to take the whole world with me. Most MCs get slapped cause they sissy. When I die, I'ma try to take the whole world with me.
Yeah.
Take
Eminem,
the whole
take
it with me.
Take it with me.
Set it.
Yeah. I'm in the soundproof booth without a roof. Circle of 180 roof.
So, welcome Nate.
What's
welcome
up?
Welcome to the Mr. Baby Podcast.
Did you say masturbating podcast?
Mr. Baby. That's,
okay.
That's the name.
I like mine better.
That's the next one.
Yeah. It's just like, what are you doing? Pretty good.
That's our theme. It's our shit.
So, what you thinking about?
Yeah.
So let's jump right
Nuns.
In.
Nuns.
So, Nate, give us your 60-second life story.
Oh, man. I don't know how I'm going to cram this into 60 seconds.
No pressure.
So, I am from Ann Arbor, Michigan in the United States, but I was actually born in Hawaii.
Okay.
And I only spent about 2 weeks there because I was adopted. So my adoptive family took me to Michigan. I grew up, in Ann Arbor, which is a small university town. Let's see,
Best friend from kindergarten lived in Ann Arbor.
Your best friend in kindergarten?
Deal.
Yeah. Do you happen to remember which school?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, I just remember she was very Christian and her parents wouldn't let her watch The Lion King because it was too violent.
I mean, I cried at The Lion King. So. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, yeah, so I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. When I was young, I did all kinds of activities. I played ice hockey. I was involved in theater. I played tennis, not well. I went to public school until the end of sixth grade when I moved to a local private school. It's kind of a college prep school, middle school and high school called Green Hills. And I went there and graduated from there, although I was not allowed to actually set foot on school property for the majority of my senior year under threat of legal action. But I was allowed to finish my diploma from home. Yeah, I did graduate.
It's surprising for a private school. It's usually they're pretty, like...
Yeah, it was a pretty extreme
you know, they're
case.
They're not lenient on...
Yeah. Well, if they take your money, they'll pretty much let you
yeah,
show up.
It was a fight to let that happen, for sure.
Can you tell us what led to that?
Yeah, I will. I definitely will. That's a whole other... That's like an entire hour by itself. So, let's see. I graduated. I wound up going to Eastern Michigan University for 2 semesters. Which was long enough to join a fraternity, go to Cancun for spring break, and then drop out. I then moved to Louisville, Kentucky, which, as I mentioned before, I was adopted. And I can circle back to this, but basically in the summer between high school and going to Eastern Michigan, mm-hmm. I learned the identities of my biological family members.
Okay.
And I wound up going down to Louisville to get to know them better.
Yeah.
And kind of for a change of pace of life, I was into some pretty bad shit.
Did you know from... Did your parents let you know you were adopted from early on?
They did. They were really cool about that. So as far back as I can remember, I've known that I was adopted, and it wasn't like a sketchy, like, you know, every time I did something bad, it's like, we're not your real parents. Like my parents, my dad especially, were always really open about that fact.
Yeah.
And, you know, happy to answer questions. And I think that they were aware that it was a potentially contributing factor to, you know, emotional trauma or issues.
I think like, that's such a crazy, like, decision you have to make of, like, like, you want to be open about it because it's like that way it doesn't blow up in your face later.
Yeah.
But it also is like, if anything goes wrong, now that's ammunition for the kid to like act out.
Yeah. I think that they chose the lesser of two evils. Oh, and then speaking of being adopted and potential emotional baggage and all that stuff, just to circle back, my adoptive parents, who initially adopted me, my adoptive mother actually passed away when I was 5 years old. She committed suicide in a rather public way. She was kind of a public figure in our hometown. She was the senior regent on the board of directors for University of Michigan. And before her, my grandfather on my dad's side was the senior regent on the board of directors for University of Michigan. And then after she passed away, my father was the senior regent on the board of directors for University of Michigan. So we're quite tied with the school. Actually, the theater there is named after my grandfather, who donated money to have it built. And like, so like,
so
it's kind of a prominent family.
Are you going to be the regent?
I doubt it. I'm the black sheep of my family. Literally every member of my family has gone to and graduated from U of M, except me. I went to Eastern for two semesters and dropped out. So yeah, probably not going to be following up on the family legacy with that. But anyway,
no blue and gold in your.
Yeah, I mean, I love the sports teams. I fully support the Wolverines. I'm kind of separated by a pretty wide buffer.
Yeah,
right.
So anyway, she passed away. My dad remarried 2 years later. But there was definitely, you know, between that and the adoption thing, there was some kindling there.
Yeah. Sounds very layered.
Yeah. So I got myself into a pretty good amount of trouble in high school. I was always up to no good. I could spend a couple days telling you guys about all my misadventures. anyway, back fast forwarding to going down to Louisville. So how does Louisville and the adoptive family come into the picture? I'm going to now tell you the story that you've been waiting for, which dovetails into this, which is the episode with the gun. So
I've been blowing this up for several weeks now, so yeah. I'm in a lot of suspense.
Before you even start that, I feel like just the topic of like the gun to different people can be totally like. Maybe I'm just looking at American scope, but it's like even that, like from coastal city or like a more like, I don't know, city liberal, it's like, what? A gun?
Yeah.
But it's just like to a lot of people like Midwest or the South, it's just like,
yeah,
this is a positive story, right?
Like, it's like
home
with
a gun.
When you say
like
that, doesn't sound like you're going to target practice, you know what I mean? Yeah. It doesn't sound like, oh, we're just
going
to go, you know,
but
shoot,
I'm saying
cans,
like to other people, it's like,
well, yeah,
what'd you do with the gun?
Yeah, Michigan is the home of the NRA, so, you know, the fact that this story is called The Gun as opposed to A Gun is like, I mean, it's pretty extreme. So.
Well, I mean, we asked you in advance to give us a few ideas of stories you might like to tell. So the way it was set up was kind of like, oh, I don't know. I mean, I have this story about Cancun and this rave, but everyone has that story. So what about the gun? This is like, what? Yeah. Like, which of these
is also like, don't go any further. Yeah. Keep it at the gun and we will discover this later.
I need to know.
So, okay, I'm gonna try in the most non-convoluted way possible to tell this story and then fit it into my general life history. Yeah. I started... What's the TV show? I started Breaking Bad kind of around freshman year in high school. I started experimenting with different drugs and alcohol and kind of running with the wrong crowd, which when you're in a private school is not really all that bad of a crowd. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've never been one to settle for mediocrity, so I decided...
Were you nearby Detroit?
Ann Arbor is about a 30-minute drive from Detroit on the highway. Detroit kind of... became more of a factor a little bit later.
Yeah, that's
a,
but that's a good
thing.
A major city, it can definitely amplify things.
Yeah, no, I was, at this time, I was like a sheltered, you know, small town kid who
desperately wanted to be a badass. He just had so long to go. So you know, I started by getting a bad reputation for myself in the confines of my private school social group, and then always wanting to be bigger and badder, and I guess due to the competitive nature of myself, you know, I wanted to expand beyond that. So I wound up getting a job when I was 15, my first job, working at a submarine sandwich shop in Ypsilanti, which neighbors Ann Arbor and is kind of like the dark side of Ann Arbor's moon. It's like the... It's not the ghetto, but compared to Ann Arbor, it's like
the
pretty
other side
fucking
of the tracks.
Yeah, it's definitely the other side of the tracks. That's where all like the sketchy folk conduct their affairs. So, I was working there. I quickly found out that the storefront, which never made any money, was a front for a wing of the Italian mafia in Detroit. That they used to run guns out of the back of. So, like, the bread truck would show up and drop off, like, the bread for the day, and then, like, these unmarked crates, and then, like, later another truck
would
show up.
Don't worry about that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, don't touch that bread. That bread can go off in your face.
Special bread.
Yeah. So, like, then, like, another truck would pick it up. I mean, anyway, that's, like, again, I could tell you a million stories surrounding the sub shop. I was working there. I started running with, like, pretty bad people. I started selling pot, which to us adults is like, ooh, you sell pot, ooh, badass. At the time, and especially, like, in that setting, like, that was pretty extreme. So, like, then I started dealing to all the kids in school, and the more business that I did and the more that I expanded my clientele, the more dangerous it got, especially as I was dealing with Ipsy kids who, like, were actually honestly from the streets. When they saw, like, a soft white kid with, like, a half ounce of pot, they're like, sweet, freebie, you know, give me your shit. So I started carrying a knife and realized that that was ineffective when a couple of guys showed up at a friend of mine's with, like, Tommy guns. And we're like, give us all your shit. So I was like, whoa, that's not cool. And, one of the other people who worked at the sub shop with me was a U.S. Marine, who was like very NRA, very like, everyone should have a gun, like guns for everybody. And so he was like, look, you dumb fuck, like, I don't approve of what you're doing, but you better protect yourself if you're going to do it. So, he sold me a little 22 caliber semi-automatic handgun. And it was small enough that it could, like, fit in my sock. It was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And it had, like, interchangeable barrels. So it had, like, the short barrel for, like, maximum concealability. Or, like, it had a long...
Accessory.
Yeah. He totally accessorized my handgun for me. It was amazing. It was the gayest, straightest thing ever.
I love the... I carried a knife, which is quickly like, oh, this does nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like, obviously not severe, but I remember I went to school in Baltimore, and the thing they would teach you is like, walk in groups for safety. It's like, you know what that doesn't protect from?
Yeah.
One guy with a gun who has now robbed seven girls at one time because they walked in a group.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, now you can all bend over at the same time and line up. So, okay, now this, it, by the time that I had purchased this handgun from this Marine, like To his credit, you know, like, he had a sketchy side, but he was law-abiding.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had turned 18. We did everything by the books. So, like, you know, went into the sheriff's, registered the sale, blah, blah, blah. Like, it was all legit.
Had you handled a gun before?
Yeah, I grew up on basically, like, an old farm. So, like, I grew up hunting and shooting. And my dad is, like, an old blue-butted wasp. So, you know, he... taught me how to shoot skeet and trap, and he would regularly go duck hunting and stuff like that. So I'm no stranger to the
He has
to
more fire. Than one jacket with a leather shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. And one of them's actually for hunting. So
a single leather.
Yeah. Corduroy.
Yeah.
With the fez. So I bought this gun. It was the beginning of my senior year in high school, at the end of that summer, and I'd been carrying it all summer, and people knew
is word, word gets around, and you know, I was very much, what's the word that I'm looking for? I was compensating for insecurities. So, you know, I think that the underlying mentality behind all of this was desperately trying to prove to myself and the world that I was tough when I did not feel tough.
Mm-hmm. So did you take it to school with you?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I and that was not a smart idea. I had I never had any intention of harming anybody. Uh-huh. I was just kind of riding the wave of popularity and infamy that that came with this thing. And you know,
you
like,
see it?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah,
you know,
well, I would guess as soon as you start having one,
yeah,
like your bravado, like,
yeah,
it can quickly give you that, like, false,
yeah,
you know, machismo or,
yeah,
like, pride.
And people would come up to me and be like, dude, do you have it with you? And I'm like, yeah.
Can
like,
we see it?
Can see it? You know, like, yeah.
Of course.
And, like, and I think to the credit of my classmates, because our school was so small and because mm-hmm. we knew each other so well, I don't think any of them for one moment ever felt that I was a danger to mm-hmm. them or to the school. And because of that, they never said anything to anybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was kind of like this, like, it almost bonded the class together in a certain way that there was, like, this group secret that we all had that no yeah. one else knew about. And, you know, it kind of spun out of control in a couple ways. Like, people would come up to me and be like, hey, you know, like, my brother got beat up. Like, can you, like, go, like, kill somebody or can you threaten them? Or, like, and I'm like, fuck no, you know. Anyway, it got to the point where, you know, we are starting to get responses to our college applications, and you know, people are going to visit schools and universities to see if, you know, they want to attend orientation and see, you know, are they a fit, blah blah blah. And my grades weren't bad, they weren't great. I spent a lot of time fucking around, but I got accepted to some decent schools. And unfortunately, like, I had my head so far up my own ass and had bought into this persona that I had developed so much by this point that when I got the kind of the first trip lined up, or not the first, I think it was like the second or third one, lined up to go to a school and kind of kick the tires for a weekend,
yeah.
stay in a dorm. I was like, this is a great opportunity for me to make some sales. So, like, I think I had like 3 or 4 ounces of weed in my trunk, and I had the gun, and I've always been an overpacker. So I had the gun, and then I had like one of these, you know, like 6 gallon freezer Ziploc bags just full of hollow point bullets, like to the brim, which I had with me, and then I had like 2 or 3 clips
just in case.
Well, because in my mentality, like, if you're gonna get into a firefight, like, you better be able to, you know, like, live through it. If you just have like 1 clip and then, you know, you're like in a gunfight, like,
yeah.
you better make those 12 shots count.
Also, like,
right?
I was like, yep. gone from I just need to have a gun in case, to, yeah, but what if it's a full on firefight?
Right.
And I need,
yeah, you know, like I said, I'm an overpacker. So, like, I had, like, you know, multiple clips. I had, like, a big bag of bullets. I had a bunch of fucking weed. And I go to this university. And, again, this was actually based on experience. I had been a couple of places before. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, these kids like to fucking party. This is awesome. And I had never brought any weed with me. And I'm like, I'm an idiot. I could be making all this money. These kids are fucking idiots. So this time I was like, all right, I'm not fucking around. I'm going to do this shit proper. So I got all prepared. I get out there, I meet the guys that I'm going to be staying with in their dorm, get up to the dorm room, I'm chatting with them, and something's off. Like, their room is really clean and organized. They have, like, exotic pet fish in an aquarium that are, like, very well taken care of. There's no algae on the glass. And as I'm talking to them, I'm like, oh my god, these guys are fucking squares. Like, they're talking about, like, it's Friday, right? And I'm like, yo, where's the party at? And they're like, oh, well, we're just planning on writing a paper. But there might be a mixer down at the fucking thing. And I'm like, what? Mixer? Are you guys wearing Bobby socks? Like, what's going on right now? And then over the course of the conversation, it dawns on me. I really should have researched where I was applying.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that this is, like, a hyper-Christian Dutch Reform school. And, like the center of, like, the Bible pocket of Western Michigan. And, like, these kids are, like, hardcore religious. They don't drink. Like, mm-hmm. they're, you know, I mean, they should have had, like, big felt hats with buckles on them. Like, and I'm just like, fuck me. And so it's a testament to my gift of gab that I was somehow able to convince one of these kids to take me to Myers and get me a bottle of Captain Morgan's. And I was like, dude, someone on this fucking campus has to be partying. And I'm like, all right, you guys have fun studying. I'm going to go look around the campus or whatever. And they're like, all right, you know, have a good one, brother, or whatever. And so I start wandering around, and it's like cricket quiet on this campus. Like, literally, like, there's just, like, not a soul to be seen. There's just nothing happening. And it's, I don't know, it was 8 at night, so it had to be, like, everyone's bedtime or something. I don't know. And I wound up walking around, getting more depressed as I walk around and see nothing happening, drinking more as I get more depressed, which is amplifying my depression. And I wind up in, like, okay, you know those, like, kind of sculpted evergreen-type bushes that they do topiary, like, boxes and spheres and all that shit? I literally wound up falling off of a set of steps into one of those bushes, and as I'm kind of suspended in the bush, I just remember, like, trying to reach the bottle that was just out of my grasp as I'm vomiting through the bush onto the ground.
Completely giving up on getting out of the bush.
Fuck everything. And I think I passed out for a little bit. And I came to at about, I don't know, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. And I, like, kind of pull myself together. And
in the bush.
In the bush. Okay. In the bush. I stumble out of this bush. Fucking drunkenly, like, make my way back to the dorm. And and somehow, like, I hadn't thought this through, but I realized as I'm approaching, I'm like, fuck, how am I going to get in? And I don't, it was, like, luck or something, but one of the two dudes that I was staying in the room with was actually at the doors to the dorm, like, hanging out.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, you know, like, holy shit, like, good to see you. And he's like, there you are. You know, we're worried about you. I'm like, nah, it's cool, you know, I just had some drinks. And he's acting super sketchy, but, like, I'm so drunk, it doesn't really compute. Yeah. And so he's like, would you care to go to the common area and watch some television? And I'm like, all right, yeah, cool, you know. And we go in, we're sitting there, and I'm just kind of, like, spacing out, like, there's something on TV. And he's, like, all fidgety. And, again, you know, I'm not, I don't really notice any of this. And all of a sudden, like, after about, like, maybe 20 minutes, it's just me and this kid in the TV lounge. This dude who is like a carbon copy of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar walks in, and he's wearing, like, I'll never forget, he's wearing a black and red checkered flannel shirt. He has the exact shaved head Kareem Abdul-Jabbar mustache. He's like 900 feet tall. like, in my head, as I looked at him, I'm like, Kareem! And he's like, Nathan? 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 And I'm just like, what the fuck? I don't know this guy. Like, he's got to be talking about another Nathan.
Yeah.
Nate? Nathan? Nate? I'm looking for a Nathan? Or a Nate? And, like, I'm just sitting there, and, like, I'm like, okay, well, there's only me and this other kid in the room, and I know I'm drunk, but I'm pretty sure he said his name was Joe. So I stood up and I'm like, I'm Nathan? And he's like, can I talk to you for a second? And I'm like, yeah. And so, like, we, like, go out to the hallway, and he's like, my name is Officer So-and-so with the Sheriff's Department. And we've received reports that you're carrying a firearm on you and have been threatening the student body. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And apparently, just to kind of backtrack to, like, the other side of what was happening while I was out drinking, apparently what had happened was I had left my bag unzipped. And,
oh, my God.
And then I'd gone off to get drunk. Yeah. And so these super, like, well-to-do kids had, like, gone back to their room, saw a gun and, like, a giant fucking Ziploc bag of bullets in my duffel bag, and were putting two and two together, like, okay, this kid seems, like, you know, like, kind of rowdy.
Yeah.
We've just bought him a bunch of alcohol. He's gone off by himself and has brought, like, a gun and a lot of ammunition with him. And, like, Columbine had just happened, like, not so, like,
yeah,
like, long before that. And so I think they were like, oh, my God, he's going to shoot up the school.
So was this, like, early 2000s or late
90s? This was 2000.
2000.
Yeah. So, like, they were freaking out, like, oh, my God, you know, we've just, you know, given this psychopath free rein to shoot up our school. So they freaked out, and they immediately called the cops. And so they were waiting for me because they were like, we don't know where this guy is. And apparently the cops were, like, patrolling everywhere while I was passed out in this bush.
They forgot to check the bush.
So, like, I come back and the guy's like, yeah, you know, like, we received blah, blah, blah reports. And I'm all drunk and I'm like, fuck the police. So I'm like, I don't have shit on me, man. You can search me. Thinking I'm all smart. So he pats me down and he's like, so how much have you had to drink? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, I think I said was, I don't understand. So he's like, all right, well, yeah, you're clean, but how about your room? Can we check your belongings? And I'm like, fuck. But I'm like, yeah, you can check my belongings. I don't have anything in there. Again, in my drunken state, thinking, like, this dumbass is going to go up to check my bag, and I'm just going to bolt, right? So I'm like, hey, got you, motherfucker. So he's like, all right. And he radios another cop to go up to the room.
Oh, my
check.
God.
Well, he stays with me, and I'm like, blast!
So, yes, sir, we do this for a living.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
We're doing.
Like, damn it, backwoods cops being professional. So that turned into a whole thing, and and I wound up, I spent the weekend in lockup. I thought by myself, interesting side story, I was in this cell. The cops at the thing were actually really, really nice, like when they realized...
The weed in the bag as well, or just the gun?
The question of my vehicle somehow never came into the whole picture. So they kind of, it was like they got what they were looking for, like case closed kind of thing, where like, I don't think anyone stopped to be like, what about his car?
Yeah.
So actually the weed never came into it. That was in my car the whole time.
Good break.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I was so lucky.
Right there, yeah.
Yeah.
So why did they put you in lockup? Just because you were drinking?
Because I was underage, drunk, and in possession of a firearm on a public school property.
Oh, there it is.
With a
fuckload
of bullets.
Right.
And, like, again, everyone's like, Columbine, Columbine!
Like, there's no law against how many bullets, but
yeah.
We can't just let you go.
Yeah. So they take me into lockup. This was a Friday, as I said before. So, like, and, you know, court doesn't open until Monday morning. So mm-hmm. I was in lockup for the weekend. The cops were, like, pretty harsh at the beginning of everything, and then, like, when they kind of began to realize that I was just basically a fucking idiot, and no real threat to anyone, and actually, like, fairly polite and, like, well-mannered and nice, they kind of cooled out and were, like, pretty decent to me, so, like, it wasn't a bad weekend in lockup, and, like, we were all kind of joking as we were taking my fingerprints, and they were giving me advice about, like, what to say and not to say on Monday when I had my arraignment and all that stuff.
I'm also going to guess this local lockup, not as bad as it.
Yeah, no, it wasn't bad at all.
City lockup, per se.
Yeah, again, as I was going to say, I thought that I was the only person in my cell until, like, late Sunday evening.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, like, the whole weekend, I thought it was just me, you know? And, like, there was a pile of blankets in the corner. And
oh, my God.
Like, you take a blanket and, you know, like, that's your thing. And then, and, you know, I'm just kind of chilling out. It was really more boring than anything else. I tried to sleep as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I was hungover, which helped the sleeping.
Yeah.
Like, Sunday, I'm just kind of sitting there waiting for Monday to come. And this pile of blankets that I assumed was, like, the communal, you know, kind of blanket trade swap meet thing started moving around. And it turned out to be this this little Mexican dude that had just been passed out for the first 2.5 days. And then, and he didn't speak a lick of English, and then he got up.
He was nocturnal? I mean, I don't understand.
He was just, apparently he was so drunk that he was just dead to the world.
Wow.
From, like, Friday evening to, like, Sunday afternoon. But then I was like, oh, shit, I have a cellmate. And then, like, we tried to communicate with each other for the next, like, 14 hours, and then, like, I got arraigned. So, okay. So, where was I going with it? Oh, right. So that turned into this whole thing where, unfortunately, as I said earlier, because my family is quite prominent, and especially because my dad is, or at the time, was in the newspaper business and had competitors in the same region, the newspapers were very quick to pick up the story of what happened. It's kind of a fuck you to him. But it was also a cool story. You know, it's worth reading. and so once that made the papers, all hell broke loose back at school.
Yeah.
Parents were calling it. I mean, everyone hated me already.
Yeah.
Like, I was the bad kid. And it, this was like, you know, just the dam breaking. So, like, parents were calling in and being like, if he comes back, I'm pulling my kid out. Like, there's no way that he's going to shoot up this school. Like, blah, blah, blah. And, like, it was this whole thing, and, like, the administration was kind of like, well, you didn't do anything on our campus, and so by our laws, like, I mean, technically, like, there's nothing that we can really get you for. On the other hand, you know, we're looking at, like, a mass exodus of parents and money.
And money.
Yeah, and so this is fucked, and we're not sure how to handle it, and there was a lot of back and forth, and ultimately, the solution was, okay, like, you can still graduate, you just can't be here because everyone's going to pull out their kids. And then also, the other upshot was that it turns out that at least one student from our class had been accepted to each of the other schools that I had been accepted at. So all of those schools got phone calls like, hey, one of the people that you've accepted just had this happen, here's the article. You should not let him in, he's a danger, blah, blah, blah. So then we all, my family got phone calls from all of them, like, hey, like, don't know what the fuck you're doing.
Has just been pulled.
Yeah, but, like, you need to handle your shit, we want nothing to do with you. So, that was basically, like, my entire college career flushed down the toilet very quickly. Which, as I think about it, was probably, subconsciously my goal all along. I think I hated school. I didn't want to continue for another 4 years and felt too much pressure from my family to go to not just be like, no, like, I don't want this. So I think that, you know, this was like a very cleverly orchestrated scenario that was unavoidable.
But you did eventually end up going to college.
Sadly, yes.
Very briefly.
Yeah. So that was like a pretty big shell shock, like, you know, it really strained my relations with my family. And even to this day, there are still scars that, you know, we all bear from that. You know, I mean, we're on way, 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 way better terms now. And it's kindly all, or mostly all past. But there's, you know, still some situations that come up where it's like...
I'm sure it's like you were saying, your father's somewhat of a prominent figure. So it's like, even if you guys are a pair of things, he's still probably like... deals with it from external people, third parties, like, who remember. And...
So, all that shit happened over the course of the weekend while I was away. My parents come to bail me out Monday, go through the arraignment, meet up with the lawyer, get back home, and like I said, we live on an old farm, and it's kind of out in the boonies, so we have our own well. We're on the grid, but we also have a generator for storms when the power goes out. We have our own septic field, and we have a sump pump, and a sump room in the house. And right when I got back, the sump pump went out, which led to my, parents going into the sump room to see what the problem was so that they could call someone to fix it and discovering the pot farm that I had growing over there. So that, honestly, it probably was best that it happened then, when it couldn't get any worse. So that happened.
We're already at maximum.
Yeah, so I was pretty fucked.
What do you have a gun for? To prick my weed farm, duh!
Yeah. Mom!
Business, you don't get it.
Yeah. So, so all that shit happened at the same time. Then there was all the blowback with the schools. And then, like, that, you know, was just an epic storm for a while. And then, you know, obviously, you know, I was on house arrest. I was... you know, the car got taken away, like, basically all of my earthly possessions got taken away, like, I mean, I was, any possible way to punish me was met out.
What about your classmates? Were they avoiding you, or did you think
it was actually it was like a mixed bag? Like the people who knew me really well were like, "Oh, Nate," because it fit me so well. A lot of people who didn't know me well were honestly afraid, and I don't blame them. I mean, because, you know, at face value, that's a really frightening thing.
Yeah.
And I think there are people to this day who are like, I almost got murdered in high school.
Well, it's also that, like, you know someone, like, you go to school with them, kind of. But, like, you hear this one thing, and then it's just like, you don't really know them, so you don't really know the story. And it's just like, I mean, I know people I went to school with that, like, looking back, it's like, oh, they were like, it's crazy. But it's like, oh, I'm sure they weren't that bad.
I mean, I would think some kids would be like, he's the man. Like,
A few. And I feel sad for them. I did get laid a couple of times from that.
Hey.
But anyway, so all that shit was happening. And then, like, all these punishments were being met out. And just as my family and I were kind of adjusting to this new draconian lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And I was... So I had, fast forward a little bit, I had now graduated, I had received my diploma.
How much time was there left in your year?
This was the second semester, so not long, it was a few months.
Okay.
4 months, something like that. So the graduation ceremony happened, we were like the class from hell, so actually like, not to be outdone, I think a few other students also got barred from attending the graduation ceremony and prom. Not for anything nearly as egregious, but like, I mean, we were just... Like, to this day, if you go back and talk to the faculty at Green Hills High School, they're like, what the fuck was wrong with you? Everyone else is great. But I blame the hip-hop music. So
every other class just is like, don't be that class. Don't be Nate's class.
Yeah, we were like the like drunken, abusive uncle that everyone else like wound up being a good person because of. So I graduated. I'm still dealing with all the court stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Life is pretty shitty, and we get this phone call. It's like kind of mid to late summer at this point. We get a phone call. My dad answers the phone, and it's this guy, and he's like, "Hi, I'm really sorry to bother you, but I am Nathan's biological grandfather, and I'm calling to inform you that his biological mother has just committed suicide. And so we're going to be having the funeral, and I'm not sure if he was ever curious about his family, and we thought that maybe this would be an opportune time to meet everybody, because they'll be in the same place at the same time, and even though it's under such horrible circumstances.
Yeah.
So now at this point, I've had one mom commit suicide when I was 5, one I never knew about, had been thinking about meeting, kill herself, kind of during a pretty bad time in my life. I'm sure it was an even worse time in her life. And I mean, at that point, like you know, in Game of Thrones, where like characters are so beat down that they adopt this attitude of like, well, fuck it. Like, I mean, what else? Like, did you bring it on at this point? Like,
I mean, this year seems like,
yeah. So I was like, yeah, fuck, I'll go meet him. Why not? Like, it gets me out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm sure at that point you've had months of not doing anything in life.
To make matters crazier, and just to add to the drama, because clearly this situation was not dramatic enough, the reason I was born in Hawaii and the reason I was adopted is because my mom, my biological mom, got pregnant with me when she was 18 and still a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who got her pregnant was a high school classmate who, to his credit, is a really stand-up guy. And as soon as he found out that she was pregnant, he immediately approached her and her family and was like, I want to marry her. I want to raise the child. Please let me do what I can. I'm taking responsibility, which is great. And that's verified from both sides of the family. So good for him. But my grandfather, my biological grandfather, who was... I wouldn't say prominent, but was a notorious figure in his community, did not want the additional notoriety associated with, you know, a child out of wedlock and the Bible Belt, and the scandal associated with it. So what he decided was he was going to smuggle her away to Hawaii to go to a clinic out there, telling her two sisters and the extended family that she had a rare disease that was only treatable out there. And so nobody knew that I existed except for my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother, who was now deceased, and my biological father. Everyone else in the family and in the community down there had no clue that I existed until the funeral. Oh my God. So, like, my grandfather calls, drops the bomb on us.
Do you know this going into, like...
I knew it on the way down.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm on the way down there with the... He came up to escort us down. So he's like, all right, let me give you the lay of the land. Like, here's your family. Here's who they are, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, also, none of them know you exist. Well, I'm telling them now, but they're just finding out. So, like, it was kind of this, like, insane crossroads of all these different emotions where there's the tragedy of their family member, my mother, passing away under extremely unfortunate circumstances. There is, like, just the shock of, like, oh my, it was, like, the perfect TV soap
opera. Yeah, that sounds very surreal.
She had a son, oh my God, and, like, and then everyone's meeting each other for the first time, and it was just, like, I honestly, I don't think I would have been able to handle it if I hadn't have already had all of my senses deadened from all the other things that I had gone through that summer. Like I said, at that point, I was just like, yeah, okay, cool. Why wouldn't this be happening right now? Like, this is fucking
great. I don't
know.
I mean, how would you even know? I mean, how would you know how to react? It's such, like, an extreme set of circumstances.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, you didn't really know her. Like, would you... I don't know. How did your family react to you finding out about you?
Thankfully, they were all super supportive, and they were... I think to them it was, like, the saving grace of, like, losing their beloved sibling or beloved family mate was... She's gone, but at least this piece of her remains. So it was kind of like a blessing in disguise. We're like,
so stuff like scandalous and more...
Yeah, it was like... Also, I mean, they're a Southern family, so, like, scandal is, like, you know, they're like, ooh, it's exciting, like, let's talk about it. Yeah.
Did she have other children?
She didn't. I was the only child. And then it gets, somehow it manages to get even crazier. So, as I'm learning about her and who she was and meeting these people at this funeral, there are, like, lots of people who are kind of involved in, like, Hollywood and, like, the entertainment industry there, and I'm like, this is kind of weird. And, like, as I learn more about her, it turns out that she, at the time of her death, was Mariah Carey's personal assistant.
Oh my God.
Okay.
And the reason she decided to end her life was that she was in, like, this really bad on-again, off-again relationship with Rod Stewart's guitarist. Who kept cheating on her, and then, like, she found out that she had early-stage ovarian cancer and then had just broken up with him for, like, the umpteenth time, and there were a bunch of other factors that just she couldn't handle anymore. But, like, she...
Did she live out in L.A.? Or
yeah, she was in L.A. She did a lot of really amazing things during her life. She was the one that came up with Crisscross wearing their clothes backwards. she was on set when Michael Jackson's hair caught fire during the Pepsi commercial. Like, she, like, did all this super crazy stuff. And, like, I mean, there weren't any, like, big stars at the funeral or anything, but it was just amazing to see this impact that she had left indirectly on my life, where it's, like, I never met my mother, but actually I had seen the way that she had touched the world and been influenced by her when I turned on the TV or when I listened to the radio, and I had no idea the entire time, and it really just kind of made me stop and think. But, and there's, like, a million stories about her and what she was involved in, but, like, so, like, hearing all that stuff was just, like, mind-blowing, and then meeting the family on both sides was mind-blowing. It turns out my biological father is a really amazing guy who was, I think, the only one, my dad, I'm going to say my real dad, but, like, my adoptive dad accompanied me down for this thing,
And my biological dad was the only one out of everybody who went up to him first instead of me and said, are you okay?
Yeah.
And I think that he understood what a really crazy situation this was for him. And unfortunately for me, I think it's easy to blame it on being overwhelmed by the situation. But bottom line is, I was also too selfish to stop and ask how this was affecting my actual dad until my biological father said something to him. And then it made me stop and realize what I was putting
into. Well, you're also 18, which...
19 at the time.
19. Yeah. But I'm sure at the time it's like, you've gone through so much stuff and you're an adult.
Yeah.
But then, like most people looking back, like 19 is not...
Yeah.
An adult.
No, I mean, like, 19, not you've never done adult. Anything yeah. for anybody, period.
Yeah. So
it's just like, you did not really grasp everyone right now. That's
insane. But, so, you know, he during the thing, was very cool and supportive, not only to me, but also to my dad. Mm-hmm. But then afterwards was also super supportive, and, like, he would write me a handwritten letter every month, and was super respectful about the part that he played in my life, and always kind of contacted my parents first. Mm-hmm. And was like, hey, you know, I kind of want to send Nathan a birthday present, but I want to make sure that's okay with you. And like, just did everything right.
Yeah.
And he was a really, really helpful kind of supportive influence during that time. And he had another son. So I have like a little half brother. And like, I'm still in touch with him to this day. And he's a great person. He does a lot of great things for the city of Louisville. And then my mom's side of the family is kind of a clusterfuck. My grandfather, who, as I said, was notorious in the community, was, you know, basically like an old hand Southern boondoggler. I mean, he's like an original Ponzi scheme guy before it had a name. So his game was...
Snake oil salesman?
Totally. He was like a modern snake oil salesman. So his game was he would buy parcels of land and claim that he hit natural gas and oil wells on them. Then he would sell shares in these to people all over the country and then take the money and buy, like, I think he... I flew on it. He had a private jet for a while. He would buy properties in, like, the Cayman Islands. He would... buy like exotic cars for his kids. Unfortunately, I worked for him for a while before I found out that this was totally illegitimate. My mother's youngest sister kind of never really left the nest and was kind of my grandfather's right-hand woman for a long time. And she,
I mean, why would you if you have a private jet?
Yeah. But she was, I mean, again, these are hillbillies at heart. So, like, she was, like, a stripper and, like, enjoyed putting meth in her orange juice. And
this is the, like, Duck Dynasty story.
Yeah.
Like, you were the Beverly Hillbillies.
I mean, they weren't, like, toothless or anything, but I'm just saying, like, you know, the blood was strong. And
the money doesn't change where they're from.
Yeah. Thankfully, the middle sister hated everything about her family and wound up... marrying a really, really bright, like tech startup guy. And she got the hell out of there and, they have a really amazing family. They're really, really good people. She has spent an inordinate amount of her time, telling me stories about my mom, sharing photo albums, really making me feel part of her immediate family. That's like the one, like, saving grace of that side. But everyone else is, like, pretty fucked up backwards hillbillies. And then my dad's side is Jewish. But I did research, and apparently it goes from your mother's side anyway. And I'm adopted. So I've spent my life telling people that I'm almost half ex-Jewish because my dad converted. So that's the early part of my life story.
Yeah. So that was the summer after high school graduation.
Yeah.
Then how did you end up going to college?
Right. So that was like the whole summer. And then my dad, being as strong-minded as he is,
was like, we're not going to let this set us back, goddammit. And so he pulled some strings.
He just wanted to get you out of there.
Yeah. No, not out of there, but I think it was, again, back to Game of Thrones. Like, you know, Tywin Lannister, like, you know, it's like all about the family name. Yeah. Like, yes. I think it's kind of that mentality where it's like, this is not going to mar the family, goddammit. Yeah. So, like, so he pulled some strings and he was like, all right, I've got you into Eastern. Yeah. Don't fuck up.
Plus, like, the break between high school and college can, like, you could start over, basically. Like,
yeah.
Let's get you on the start over track.
Yeah, exactly. And I think at that point, everyone was in the mentality where it's like, well, it can't get any worse. Yeah. So, yeah, so I went to Eastern, struggled through the first semester, joined the same fraternity that my older brother was in. It's a, older brother is my dad's second wife's son from a previous marriage. So he's 11 years older than me. We used to get along extremely well when I was extremely young. Then it turned out that he was kind of a square, when he was starting medical school and I was like starting to be like a teenage fuck up.
Yeah.
So then we kind of parted ways. Then he, wound up marrying like a really cool wife, that like got him to smoke pot, and like now he's like really chilled out and awesome, and he's like the cool doctor that's like, everyone should smoke weed, like, that's great. So like now it's like very cool once again. But anyway, I went to the same fraternity that he was in because I thought that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Turns out there were a bunch of douchebags, but I did get a Cancun trip out of it. Had many misadventures in Cancun, which is a whole other ball of wax.
But what happened that made you not go back to school?
I just couldn't take it anymore after two semesters. I was like, this is not who I am.
Yeah,
I can't do this.
Friend the exact same thing. He like never really wanted to go to university, yeah. And even if he did, he wanted to go for arts.
Yeah.
Because he was like, I don't want to go in the first place.
Yeah.
But I ended up going to Temple.
Yeah.
I think he was there for maybe not even 1 year. His GPA was 0.8.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm just going to not go back.
That sounds like my GPA.
Yeah, like clearly this is not happening.
Yeah. It's not apparent now because I've done a lot of drugs between then and now, but I used to be like one of those kids that was so smart that I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
Like I just constantly got in my own way. And that was like, that was my issue all throughout school. And then also, especially when now you put me in an unstructured environment where like I'm supposed to police myself. Like I would go to a class and be like, all right, yeah, I get it. Like I can take the final exam. And then just never go back. And then when it came time for the exam, I was like, eh, I want to, like, go play Frisbee. And then, you know, I mean, it was just, like, it would not work. So
while you were in Cancun, did you go to MTV Spring Break?
I did not, that I know of. Honestly, I was so drunk.
I maybe have. I don't
All know. I remember about Cancun is, okay, I remember, like, three things. I remember bungee jumping naked off of a crane for a free t-shirt. I remember, I remember I took some chick back to the shared hotel room that was like me and three other dudes, and they had three beds. It was like a loft, like with like the half balcony.
Yeah.
And like, so there were three beds up on the half balcony, and there was like the living room kitchenette downstairs, but the couch pulled out. And so I had the couch. And
oh my God.
It wasn't like a couch. It was like a couch. So it was like wood frame with like a pad and some pillows on it. And all I remember is, I'm such a sadist. I'm fucking this chick doggy style, and her head is like in the corner where the arm meets the back of the couch. And it started off as an accident where like I kind of thrust too hard, and her head like hit the wood. And she was like, ow, and I'm like, so I started like doing it really hard. So it's like, bam, ow, bam, ow, bam, ow. And like I'm laughing and like getting off on him. And all of a sudden it's like too quiet in the room. And all the lights were off, and I'm like, just like, you know when the hair on the back of your neck stands up? And I turn around, and all I can see is like a red dot floating in the darkness, like a red glowing dot. And I'm like, oh my God, the demons have finally come for me. And like I stop, and I'm like looking, and I'm like, I hear like kind of like muffled laughing. And I'm like looking, and the lights turn on. It's the three dudes that I'm sharing the room with, like with the video camera, standing at the foot of the couch. Like, like, and I was like, fuck it. So I wound up basically shooting a porno with this chick. And like, they kept videotaping for like the next like half hour or so. And then, yeah, so I can't run for Senate because that's out there somewhere.
There's a VHS tape somewhere.
Yeah. And then the only other thing that I remember from the Cancun trip was, I was about to miss my flight. I didn't have enough money for the taxi to leave. And so I wound up dragging all of my belongings to, like, the different street side vendors who were hawking, like, shirts and hats and ice cream cones or whatever, and just opening my suitcases and being like, I need taxi money, take what you want, and give me this much. And so, like it didn't work the first two or three times, and finally some dude was like, all right, cool, and, like, rifled through all my shit, took, like, three quarters of, like, my belongings, and was like, you know, I think he gave me, like, $40 or something. It was enough to get me to the airport. And the only thing that I kept was one of those stupid oversized sombreros that's, like, this big, which I refused to remove.
Now, the you're selling back to them is just a bunch of shit you've gotten down there?
No, it was, like, my stuff. It was, like, my stuff from that I brought with me.
Did you keep the free naked bungee jumping t-shirt?
Yeah, I had that. I was wearing that. I was wearing that, and then I had
I never took that off.
Yeah, I didn't. And then I had the oversized sombrero, which I did not remove on the plane. And I had the middle seat. So, like, the people on either side of me were sitting like this. And I think the stewardesses would have
been... You are officially the most cliche college person that can't get ever.
I'm that guy. And I think I would have gotten beaten up or removed from the flight, or at least the stewardesses would have told me to take my sombrero off. But it was the college return flight from Cancun, and everyone was just, like, passing around bottles of tequila.
Oh, my
God. It was just cool. So, like, the whole way back, I'm like, yeah.
Don't even bother.
Yeah.
Sean and I went to art school, so we just kind of assume that everyone who goes to real college is exactly like you.
Yeah, they are. I wish I had gone to liberal arts. Yeah, so anyway. Okay, so that was Cancun.
You would have cleaned up, because it's a very high... girl-to-boy ratio.
Damn it.
Especially straight-boy ratio.
Yeah. What time are we at right now?
About an hour.
Okay. Do you want me to keep going, or are we good?
Going.
Yeah.
Yeah?
So, after finishing school, how'd you...
After being finished with school.
Yeah, after being finished with school. Where'd you take it from there?
So,
back to Kentucky?
Yeah, that was the everyone in Kentucky had been kind of pining after me to come down there. They all wanted to get to know me better. I was their only tie to my mother.
Were you kind of the baby?
What do you mean?
I mean, were there younger kids?
Yeah, it's Kentucky.
Around?
So I had I had two uncles that were younger than me through my grandfather. So I had my my uncle from my grandfather's short-lived marriage to a Swedish ex-supermodel.
Sure.
Who was 3 years younger than me. And then I had my uncle, who was my grandfather's kid with the maid, who was 13 years younger than me.
I keep forgetting you were saying your biological grandfather was, like a business guy, and I keep picturing him more as the, like, southern, like, who's the guy? The guy from, like, that infamous church down south.
You know who he looked
like? Like, just like a reverend father who has, like, his family.
He was basically a carbon copy of Santa Claus.
Okay.
He was, like, a 300-plus pound, huge, snow-white bearded, southern fat guy.
He's the colonel.
Your whole life is like...
He actually was a Kentucky colonel. He was a registered Kentucky colonel.
It's like Game of Thrones, Beverly Hillbilly crossover.
Yeah, yeah.
You're fine, you can keep going.
Duck Dynasty of Thrones? I don't know.
Duck Dynasty of Thrones. One day all this will be yours.
Yeah. And your sister, too. Okay, yeah, so... I was like, fuck, I'm not going to go to school. I kind of need to just get away from all of this shit.
Mm-hmm. So you told your dad, I'm not coming back. I'm going to...
Well, I didn't say I'm not coming back, but I was like, you know, I think I just need a change of scenery. And my dad was like, yeah. So I was going to go down there and work for my grandfather and just kind of spend some time somewhere else and get to know my family better. And I think my parents, God bless them, were just, like, flabbergasted with how to deal with me, and their mentality was like, sure, you guys take a shot. Like, good luck. So I wound up down there. It started off pretty cool, but I still had a lot of demons to work out, especially with my biological father, who was just so enamored with me. and wanted to do absolutely anything for me. But I don't think that I realized that I was acting out kind of repressed emotions towards him and the whole situation. He has been a registered member of AA for like the past, I don't know, 20, it was 20 something years at that point. Now it's 30, whatever. And was, you know, adamantly, against, drinking for himself. And because I was his son, was very concerned about me going down the wrong path, especially because, you know, at that point I had a history of abusing drugs and alcohol and just, you know, being crazy. And he was very concerned about that. And yet, despite that, he wanted so much to do anything he could for me that, like, I remember when I first came down there, I convinced him to go buy me and my uncle, who were both underage at the time, like a 12-pack of beer, so that, like, we could, like, get drunk, and, like, we were actually, like, drinking in front of him while we were talking to him, and then, like, I think I went and, like, drove somewhere, and, like, I mean, it didn't dawn on me until much later, like, what kind of hell that had to be putting him through, and how truly dedicated he was to go along with that, you know, no matter how much he was screaming inside. So that was not great.
Did he have kids of his own at this point?
Yeah, now he has two more kids. At the time, he had his son, who is my half-brother, who is, I want to say, 15 years younger than I am. 15 or 16 years younger than I am. He was like cute as a button when he was a little kid. I used to have like a really crazy sound system in my car, and like he always wanted to ride with me whenever I went to dinner with them, because like he would always ask me to turn up the bass, and like he was just like just the cutest little kid, and he's still like killing it. He's like such a ladies' man. Like I feel looking at him like he's everything I could have been if I wasn't so completely fucked up. But yeah, I'm really proud of the kid. He's a good kid. Anyway, so okay. Yeah, so I moved down there, started working for my grandfather, selling shares in these non-existent natural gas and oil wells, going on family trips, learning more about my family and how fucked up they were. Spent a lot of time hanging out with my uncle. He and I were fairly inseparable until my extremely attractive but extremely crazy ex-girlfriend decided to come visit me under the auspices of moving to Florida, but in actuality, she wanted to steal my cat. And wound up revenge fucking him to try to get at me, which worked. And then I threatened to kill him, and we haven't spoken since.
Oh, no.
So that is, I guess.
What happened to the cat?
I kept him. I kept him. No one was fucking with my cat.
You're not taking him too.
Yeah. you want to fuck the cat next? and there were lots of misadventures in Louisville as well. We lived in an apartment compound, and I was on the fourth floor, and on the second floor, I don't know why, but I guess throughout the compound were housed a lot of, wrestlers for WWE.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not like the A-listers who clearly were rich enough to have their own houses, but these were like the up-and-comers.
Is that in Tennessee?
Yeah, like, yeah. No, this is Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky.
It's the same
thing. Sure they have, like, schools down there. There's a bunch of, like, kind of, almost like, what'd you say?
Like dorms?
Not dorms, but just like a minor, not a minor league, but like, I don't know what I'm...
Like,
where they can train them before they go into the big... Like, they're under contract, but they need to be...
Yeah, like, it's still WWE, but it's, like, the local circuit. Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. Yeah, exactly. Like, building the brand, so...
Mm-hmm.
A few of those guys lived in the compound, but one lived downstairs from us, and he was this huge, enormous black dude named... and he was very nice, but didn't really speak much. But he lived there with his nephew, who was like a skinny little white kid from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they were related, but But he used to come upstairs all the time, and he was one of these people who, like, is just, like, as nice as can be and, like, pure as the driven snow. But how did Ross Perot put it? He was about as smart as a sack full of hammers. I mean, he would be, like, totally well-meaning, but, like, his conversation starter would be, like, he comes into the room, and you're making a sandwich, and he would be like, "Hey, what are you doing?" And you'd be like, "I'm making a sandwich." Like, very clearly, this is what's happening right now. And he'd be like, "Oh, so are you making a sandwich?" Like, not a dry bone of humor in his body. Like, that was how he computed things. And you're like, "Yes, Alan, I'm making a sandwich." He's like, "I like sandwiches." And then, you know, sit down and, like, fucking take a bong rip. And, you know, like, it was cool. He was harmless. Really nice guy. But through him, we found out that who lived downstairs was into, like, really hardcore gay S&M, and would frequently, like, Alan would walk into the apartment while he's, like, on the webcam in, like, full leather, this dick out, and then just like, "Oh, hey, Alan," you know, there's ice cream in the freezer or whatever. So maybe that's why the kid was so oblivious.
Like,
I don't know.
Not only into it, but way too casual about it.
Yeah. So, let's see, there was that, and then,
how long were you living there for?
I was there for 4 years. Oh, right. So, I started off working for my grandfather, realized that I was involved in some sketchy shit. Yeah. And I'm glad I got out when I did, because the FBI wound up raiding his office, and then he got, like, I think, like, 40-something different counts of all kinds of federal, like, shit.
Yeah.
I think including, like, grand larceny and, like, other stuff. I wound up serving the last 6 years of his life in federal prison. But so I got out of that. I'd always been, like, a rave kid. And I'd always been into music, had been obsessed with learning how to DJ. And that had always been my hobby. And I was like, "Yo, I'm in a new place." And, like, you know, my skill set was not nearly good enough to be applicable in the Detroit scene, which is, like, really serious shit. But I was like, "Fuck, you know, this hillbilly town, I'm going to start throwing raves." And, like, you know. So I started up a production company. I found some other DJs. We started doing, like, club events and throwing parties. And actually, we got pretty big for a while. Like, we were doing pretty big shows, at least for that area, with, like, I think our biggest show was, like, 2,500 people, which is, for, you know, the South, it's pretty good. And, like, we booked some big names, and during the course of that time, I actually learned how to DJ properly and made a lot of connections in the industry and learned a lot about managing artists and just the way that everything worked. Unfortunately, just as I had kind of accumulated that skill set, I also realized that DJing for a living sucked all of the fun out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're trying to pay your bills playing music, you have to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
You have to play whatever people want. You have to play where people want. You have to play when people want. You have to do weddings. You have to do birthday parties. Oh. I basically quit at that point. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, you know, this has been a good run, but this is not where I want to take my life. And so I was like, well, I don't know what to do.
Bat mitzvahs, and you're like, yeah, I can't take it anymore.
Exactly. It's like, you know, my wrist was getting arthritis from all the scissors. And no bris jokes.
Yeah. Okay. You didn't get paid enough to do that.
I kind of learned everything there was to learn about my family, and you know, the sheen had worn off at that point. And, like,
yeah,
you know, it's like, fuck, dude, I really want to get out of here. I really want to go back home.
Yeah.
I felt like I had left at kind of a shitty time and wanted to see what it would be like when the dust had settled. Kind of missed my actual family up there. And so I was like, all right, I'll go back. And I went back. Things were cool for a little bit. I had no idea what direction I wanted to take my life in. Wound up buying a house with a good friend of mine from high school, one of the few people that stayed very, very close with me. After everything that happened, I lived in the basement. He lived on the main floor for a while he was finishing up pilot school. I didn't really know what to do. I went back to selling weed, Not in like a heavy way, but just like enough so that I could smoke for free.
This is back in Ann Arbor?
Yeah. And then like, I've always been like a big gamer. I love video games. Someone got me into World of Warcraft had just come out right at that time. And vaporizers had also just come out. And the big thing was the volcano vaporizer, which was like, it literally looked like a volcano, and it had a nozzle on top, and you would put a contraption that had a chamber for your weed, and then the contraption was attached to like a big plastic like turkey bag, and you'd put that on top.
Fill the bag.
Yeah, and it would inflate like a balloon with the hot air from the volcano. And then you'd clip a little mouthpiece on, and then you'd inhale the vapor from the bag. You could pass it around. So it was kind of like the meeting point of video games, really strong weed, vapor, and having a basement all to myself. I spent the next 3 years, I don't think I left my house more than like five times. Like I basically
quite
just,
literally a haze for the next 3 years.
Yeah, quite literally. I just lived in my basement and smoked pot and played World of Warcraft. And I think that was kind of the final stage of, like, coping or healing from everything that I had been through. And I think that after all that, I just needed to kind of zone out for a little bit. Mm-hmm. I did. And after about 3 years, I was starting to get antsy. And my dad was like, look, you know, what the fuck are you doing? You're stagnating. You're not doing anything. You need to figure out what's next. And I was like, yeah, you're totally right. And I wound up going to University of Michigan, not as an enrolled student, but to get my TESOL / TEFL teaching certificate with the intention of going to Vietnam. To teach English for a year. I chose Vietnam because I've had the good fortune to travel all over the world throughout my life. And I've been everywhere but Asia at that point. So I was like, all right, I'm going to see Asia. I'm going to teach some English. Vietnam's good because I speak a little bit of French. And my dumbass thought that that would somehow work. I was like, all right, I'm going to do this and find myself. And then, you know, at least I'm doing something and we'll figure out what's next as that happens. Family's like, great. I'm like, great. Okay, cool. Make all my plans. And made a post about it on Facebook. And a friend of mine, let me just backtrack really quick. as all these really terrible things were happening, and slightly before, like I basically went from like selling pot throughout most of high school. My senior year of high school, I moved into, well, it had always been like natural stuff, pot, mushrooms, you know, hippie high school kid type of shit. Right after high school, as all this terrible shit was happening, one of my friends from Ypsilanti was like, dude, your shit is fucked up. You need a hit of ecstasy. And so, like, I did E, and that was, like, amazing. Like, I was able to actually feel happy for a while. And, like, I was like, this is great. I got into that whole culture, got seriously into, like, the rave culture, started doing and selling, like, every drug you can think of.
Is that when you also bought your neon mesh shirt and pacifier?
No. I was never a candy kid. Detroit is, like, it's a really, really weird electronic music scene. Everywhere else you look in the world, you know, it's all very heavily influenced by ecstasy. And, you know, the people that are involved are, like, very, like, nouveau hippie, like, free love, outgoing, like, do you want a massage or a blowjob? Like, here's a bracelet that I made for you. Like, you know, kind of mentality. Detroit, which is a really fucked up, dangerous city, the first wave of electronic music, because it got invented there, didn't come prepackaged. Electronic music was not invented in Detroit. Techno, as we know it today, was invented in Detroit. And because it developed on its own, the people that were into it were first just nerds who were into it for the music, like everywhere else that it got invented. Yeah. But then the party kids were actually into acid. They weren't into ecstasy. And they were into, like, mind-fucky, like, kind of dark shit. You go to a Detroit party, it's like a bunch of people wearing all black and hyper minimalist, like giant warehouse room,
that is covered in like 10-inch white foam padding. First, so that you don't step on the broken glass on the floor of the warehouse. Oh. And second, to disorient you so that while you're on LSD, you're trying to walk and like everything's squishy and like the walls, like there's no hard surfaces, right? So you're just like, fuck. And then it's this giant warehouse with like, let's say 8,000 people in it. And in the whole thing, it's giant, giant speaker system, mm-hmm. just bass so loud that like your heart stops when it hits. And there's just one DJ in one corner of the warehouse with a single red light behind them, shining up so they're silhouetted, and it hits the ceiling, and that's the light in the whole thing. That's it. And it's just this dark, like, fucking heavy, like, really just visceral techno music. Not industrial. No. It's, like, super stripped down, minimal, like, just a bass, mm-hmm. like, kick, maybe a clap that comes in for, like, 15 seconds, but just this throbbing bass that you totally lose yourself in. So, like, long answer to a short question. Like, no, I was not a candy kid. Like, it was a lot darker than that. Anyway, so I got into the rave scene. I started selling all kinds of shit. I started getting involved with higher and higher echelons of selling all kinds of shit. Eventually, I wound up working with this guy. Let's call him Uncle James. Who was responsible for flooding the market in the tri-state area with ecstasy from the pill presses run by the Hells Angels and the Triads in Canada. So he would ship the shit across the river, distribute it to everybody, and that's how everyone mm-hmm. got high on E. And I started working directly under him. And it was really crazy because, you know, again, kind of an ego stroking kind of thing, which I've always had a weakness for. I could go to any party and someone would come up to me and be like, hey, do you want some pills? And I'd be like, what kind of pills? And they'd be like, you know, green Pikachus or fucking white Mitsubishis or whatever. And I'm like, yeah? Are those pretty good? They're like, oh, man, they're the best. And I'm like, you're welcome. So I was working for this guy. Fuck the stories I have with this guy. I'll tell you two really quick. Okay, if we have time.
Do it.
First one is, this is like my own personal brush with fame as it goes. I was at a rave at the Michigan State Fairgrounds one time, and there were all these performers there. It was a really big party. And a friend of mine's ex-girlfriend, who's extremely attractive, was trying to get herself into the VIP mm-hmm. because Too Short was performing, and she has this thing for black guys, so she was like, I'm gonna fuck him. Like, she finally, like, weasels her way into the VIP, hooks up with Too Short, and he's down, because, you know, she's, like, a little blonde chick, and he's like, yeah.
I mean, what else is there to do in Michigan?
Yeah, exactly. So, and he's like, so what's up? Are we gonna party? Like, where's the drugs at? And she's like, alright, I got you, hold on. She sends the bouncer to come find me, and, like, I'm just, like, hanging out, partying. And the bouncer comes up, puts his hand on my shoulder. I'm like, fuck. I'm like, I'm really careful about this shit. Like, I never hold anything. I always have someone else moving something. I always have someone else holding my money. I'm just there to party, you know? And I'm like, how the fuck did I get found out? Yeah. And the dude is like, you the guy with the drugs? I'm like, hell no. And he's like, no, seriously, because we need you in the VIP.
Opposite of what you're thinking.
Yeah. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, if this is some kind of trick that I'm falling for right now, I'm never going to throw this off. I'm like, yeah, okay. And he's like, all right, cool, grab your shit and come on. I'm like, dude, I'm going to get fucking, like, I do it because I'm dumb. And it was actually a real thing. He takes me into the VIP. I meet Too Short. And he's like, so you're the guy with the stuff? And I'm like, yeah, I got what you need. And he's like, all right, let's take a ride. We go out through the back artist entrance. We get into his limousine and just start driving around in the parking lot, the Michigan State Fairgrounds. And like, you know, we're talking about everything. He's like saying what he wants, blah, 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 asking price. I'm like, you're fucking Too Short. I'm like, here. I'm in a limousine with Too Short. Have my drugs. It's cool. And like, I think in his mind he knew that was going to happen. Yeah. He's like, yeah. And I'm like, so what are we driving around the parking lot for? And he's like, oh, I need to find this bitch's purse. So like the chick had given him her keys and he was going to kill two birds with one stone, like get the drugs. And he like finds the car. And he's like, you mind getting that shit? So I, like, go get this chick's purse out of her car, give it to him. He drops me back off at the artist entrance and, like, goes back to, like, get this chick and, like, go fuck her somewhere. And then, because he dropped me off on the artist side, and I'm like, I'm not going back in. Like, I'm hanging out back here. So I wound up hanging out backstage, and I met, like, Wu-Tang Killer Army and, like, some of the guys from the Dirty Dozen and, like, who else was there? Richard Humpty Vision and Bad Boy Bill, I think that was who was there. So that was really crazy.
Michigan State Fairgrounds.
Yeah, woo-woo! All right, and then this is, like, I have a never-ending series of events that I went through in my days as, like, a proper real drug dealer, but it all kind of culminates in this one story that I will tell you. And the purpose of all of this is to tie back into Uncle James and how he affected my trip to Asia. So as the business went on, James was trying to hand over more and more responsibility to me and be less and less involved on his own, because to be involved is to be exposed. Yeah. He just wanted his money, and, you know, he wanted to be hands-off, which is kind of the goal for every drug dealer. And I was young, and I was making a lot more money than I knew what to do with, and I was happy to take on risk because I'm an idiot. So I was hooking up I was basically distributing to his distributors for various areas around the tri-state zone. One of them was in western Michigan in Kalamazoo, who basically was in charge of the west side of the state. And this was actually a guy that I had recruited and kind of built up. A really loyal guy. Kind of a meathead. Like, he's kind of a guy that you would expect to see on a baseball team as opposed to at a rave. But, you know, it takes all kinds. So, this guy calls me up one day, this guy on the west side of the state. He's like, hey, man, I have really good news. I got a new customer, big, big business. I'm like, all right, you know, don't talk to me about it on the phone. I'll be out there this weekend. I come out, I talk to him about it. He gives me the skinny. He's like, yeah, I met this new guy. He wants to buy, like, a big batch of, like, XYZ. He wants a bunch of cocaine. He wants ecstasy. He wants the whole smorgasbord, yeah. Right? And he's offering a really great price. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, this is unrealistic. Yeah. Like, yeah, this doesn't make sense. And I'm grilling him. I'm like, how do you know the guy? Blah, blah, blah. Like, do you know him directly? How long have you known him? And he's like, oh, no, no, no. One of my friends introduced me to him. And I'm like, tell me more about your friend. And as we talk about it, I realize that this friend has just gone to jail for selling drugs and then inexplicably is now out and trying to introduce somebody yeah, to a major distributor, right? And I'm like, dude, are you stupid? And he's like, what? I'm like, think about this. I'm like, just don't do anything. Don't tell him yes or no just yet. Just sit tight. Because, I mean, greed drives this kind of operation, yeah. Right? So it's very probably a setup. But on the off chance that this is a windfall, there's a fuckload of money to be made from it, right? I have to treat it seriously. Go back to Uncle James. Tell him the whole lowdown about everything. Tell him, in no weak sense, my inhibitions about this deal and that I think it's really skunky.
Yeah.
He shares my thoughts. We agree that, again, we're greedy as fuck. There's a lot of money on the table. What we're going to do is we're going to go talk to some of his sketchy Arab friends in Dearborn. And he proceeds to procure a counter-surveillance kit from them. It is like a unmarked black metal suitcase that has, like, it's like a James Bond fucking awesome thing. It's, like, lined with, like, foam that has cutouts for, like, the phone tap checker and, like, there are all kinds of really sweet gadgets. I remember it had, like, the like, shotgun mic, you know, it has, like, it looks like a little satellite dish on it. And, like, you aim it at stuff and you can hear shit that's, like, 200 yards away. And it had, like, a counter-infrared scanner that would tell you if, like, someone was pointing a laser beam at you. Like, I mean, just everything under the sun.
Yeah.
Right? You could sweep for microphones. I mean, it was, like, serious, like, MI6 shit. So we take that thing. We set up a day to do the deal. We're like, all right, we'll do it. Make sure you have the cash. We'll meet you at this place at this time. And it was in this apartment compound where this distributor guy lived, right? Mm-hmm. And we set a time for, I can't remember exactly. I think we said 5. But we showed up at 11 a.m. And
got everything set up. And Uncle James had just bought a new puppy at the time. So we have everything kind of set up. And we're keeping an eye on the parking lots and, you know, sweeping for bugs inside the apartment. And generally just kind of keeping an eye out for shit. About 90 minutes before the deal is supposed to go down, through one of the windows into the apartment, we start picking up like a laser being shot at us, right? So we're like, and we start talking about nothing scandalous at all,
yeah,
right? Just like the weather, what we're going to have for breakfast, blah, blah, blah. And we're writing notes to each other mm-hmm. about what the plan is, right? So I grab James's dog and I go out and take the dog for a walk. And these guys have never seen James or I before. They mm-hmm. only know the distributor and his people.
Yeah.
And I go down the fire stairs instead of the main entrance of the building and just come around the corner walking a dog. Right? So these guys have no reason to look at me. I'm just some guy walking a dog. I spot an unmarked white van in the parking lot. And they're parked where I can, like, get pretty close to them without looking suspicious. In Michigan, government vehicles have a small X in the middle of their license plate as opposed to a seventh letter or digit. So normally it's seven things.
Yeah.
On a government plate, it's three letters or numbers, a small X, and then another three. This had that. So that's a super bad sign.
Because you'd think for undercover they would allow yeah. you to switch out plates. On.
I also think that they probably had no idea that yeah. we were there with a counter-surveillance yeah. kit. You know, they were like, these are idiot drug dealers. Like, we also had walkie-talkies. So I'm like, yo, like, there's a fucking thing in the thing. Yeah.
So you guys are in a different part of the apartment complex, right? Like, you're not in his house or...
No, we started in his house.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because, like, that's... You can't counter-surveil someone else's apartment.
I don't know.
Like, that's what they're going to be looking yeah. at. So, like, that's where we detect what's going on. Also, we didn't have any drugs inside the apartment. Like, we made sure it was clean. So, like, if some shit went down, it's a group of people in an apartment. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. And we didn't say anything while they're recording. So there's nothing that they can have us on. So I come back. Again, I go, like, the super, super long way around. Come back in up the back of the building, right out. It's definitely a setup. And we give a small amount of drugs to the guy because mm-hmm. it's got to end somewhere. Right, and then Uncle James and I take off. Homeboy gets rolled, but it's such a small amount that it's like I think he got out like after like a couple of days. Like we just had the lawyer post bail, and then yeah. like he paid a fine and got like community service or something. I mean, it was like a slap on the wrist. But we had to do that because if nothing happened, it would have been an ongoing investigation. Yeah. Instead. It just looked like this guy said that he could get all this shit. Actually, he could only... Yeah, he's just a small-time guy. And James set him up with someone else to roll on as part of his plea deal, who was competition. And the thing went away. It was fine. But that was like that was one of the craziest things that we've ever done. On the whole way back, we're like high-fiving each other. Like, what did that really just happen? Like, that was fucking crazy.
What happened in the surveillance kit?
He still has it somewhere.
He still has it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like
yeah.
you go out every week and surveil shit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. that was so nuts, man. I feel like we wouldn't have had the balls to do half the things that we do if we hadn't have been, like, so out of it on the drugs that we were on. Like, it just, like, it was so surreal that it made yeah. it, like, livable. So anyway, okay, so that's Uncle James. That's who he is. He wound up retiring
mm-hmm.
and... taking all the money that he had made and moving to China, Shanghai, China, which is, he'd always been obsessed with Chinese culture growing up.
Yeah.
He has yellow fever worse than any person I've ever met in my life. And like, from the time that he started dealing drugs, he was like, I need to get it. Cause he's from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, I'm getting out of this hellhole.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make a fuck ton of money. I'm moving to the paradise, which is China. And I'm just gonna fuck Chinese chicks for the rest of my life. I'm gonna be super happy. And that's what he wound up doing. He made a bunch of money. He moved here. And on Facebook, I hadn't talked to him for a really long yeah. time. Basically, halfway through Louisville, like, you know, when you're out of the game,
yeah.
you kind of, like, go in different directions. You're either, that's your whole life.
You're not casual buddies with these people.
Yeah. But we're Facebook friends. So I guess that's casual.
And and so I made this post like, I'm going to go to Vietnam for a year. I'm going to teach English. I'm excited to explore Asia. And he immediately sends me a private message. He's like, what are you doing, you idiot? He's like, don't you know I'm in China? I'm in Shanghai. And I actually didn't know that. Like, I hadn't talked to him. I'm like, oh, cool. He's like, don't go to Vietnam, you moron. Come to Shanghai. I have this really dope apartment. It's a 3-bedroom. I'm only using one of them. You have another bedroom. I'll help you get a job. I'll get you a girlfriend. Man, we're going to eat this Chinese food. We're going to have such a good time. You'll love China. And I'm like, okay. Like, sure. this is fucking awesome. Great. Yeah, cool. And I change all my plans, and I buy new plane tickets.
But do they speak French there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Tell me about the croissant situation.
Will my language skills get me along?
He's like, I got you. I speak Chinese. Fuck it. I'll take care of you, dude. Just come. I've been missing having a friend here. Like, I love it, but it would be great to have someone from back home. And we're going to go on adventures. And, man, this is going to be great. I'm like, fuck yeah. This is awesome. Change all my plans. About, I think it was 6 days before I get on a plane to come here. I get an email from him. And he's like, hey, I have good news and I have bad news. The bad news is the feds finally caught up with me and have informed me that I can either fly back to the U.S. and turn myself in to do a bit in the federal penitentiary, or they're going to revoke my passport and I'm on my own and I'm never going to see my grandmother again, and I don't know, like, I can't stay in China without a visa, without a passport, so I've pretty much got to go back and face the music. The good news is that I talked to the landlord, and he said that you can have the lease on the apartment, and I've written down a list of names and phone numbers that you can call for leads on jobs. And
I will not break my promises to you.
Yeah, it's like, so, you know, good luck, buddy. I know that you don't speak the language or know anything about China, and that I'm the resident expert and convinced you to come here, but see you in 5 years. Thankfully, the guy who owned the apartment that he was living in is a white guy from Seattle. Mm-hmm. And James put me in to touch with this guy. And in the very short time, he was very, very kind and responsible. Mm-hmm. I explained the situation to him. And this guy knows James pretty well. So he was like, oh, James.
Like, he knew his background.
Yeah. So he's like, oh, you so-and-so. And so, like, I was like, look, you know, I was kind of counting on James for a lot of this shit. I don't know shit. I don't know anybody. I don't know any language. I'm fucked when I get here. And he's like, all right, all right. He writes me back 2 days later, and he's like, that's cool. I've got it handled. I met this guy in a bar who says that he'd be happy to manage the apartment for me. So I'm just going to give him the keys, and he'll take care of you when you arrive. I'm sure he's fine. And thankfully, instead of this guy just stealing his apartment and doing God knows what with it, actually wound up being, to me, one of my best friends here. He actually screwed the landlord out of about $20,000. But he always took good care of me.
Yeah.
So this guy, the landlord gave me his phone number. I landed here. I called him. I'm like, hey, I'm Nate. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm Chris. You know, I knew you were coming. Give the phone to the taxi guy. I'll tell him how to get here. He guides me in. Takes me up to the apartment. I put down my luggage. He hands me a beer and a joint. He's like, welcome to China. And then that guy basically was like my liaison for the first 6 months that I was here until I started kind of getting my feet under me.
Wow.
But if it wasn't for that guy, I would be fucked. and then he wound up developing a really bad coke habit and having to move to Taiwan, where he now owns a really successful bar. So good for him. But yeah, so that's how I got to China.
That's quite a runaround.
What does your family think about you being in China?
They're very happy.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
No.
They were very proud that I was willing to uproot and go somewhere completely alien, and that I stuck with it. Mm-hmm. They were... I don't think that they thought anything bad about teaching English, but they were very happy when, after I decided to stay... I didn't renew my English contract and instead got a quote-unquote real job as the business development manager for like a big national chain of Chinese language schools here. And then my job involved doing a lot of travel. I was flying to like Europe and North America to attend business conferences and recruit agencies to send students to our school. So, you know, it was like a jet set kind of job, and my family was like, oh my God, he's not a fucking idiot anymore.
How'd you end up linking up with Matt?
So, Matt, okay, so the first night I got here, this guy, Chris, hands me a beer and a joint. Welcome to China. We smoked the joint, I drank the beer. He goes, okay, let's get you out on the town. And he's like, so what are you trying to do here? And I'm like, oh, I want to teach English. And he's like, all right, let's get you a job and get you introduced to some people.
Yeah.
And he first takes me back over to his house. Matt was his roommate at the time.
Oh, wow.
So I met Matt my first night here. I also met his other roommate, who is this really unfortunate Irish guy whose nickname was Irish. And so I meet them, and I'm like, hey, what's up? I'm Nate. I'm new here. And Matt's like, hey, I'm Matt. And Irish goes, oh, they call me Irish. I fucked a ladyboy. And I'm like, what? And he's like, oh, I fucked a ladyboy. On more than one occasion. I just figured I'd tell you because they're gonna anyway. And I'm like, okay, nice to meet you. And then, so that was them. And then I met a couple other people who are still in my circle of friends who are all kind of Chris's circle. Chris had this amazing ability to be this catalyst who brought people together. Yeah. A lot of my closest friends here I know because of him. My good friend Kyle, who was my first roommate here, was introduced to me by Chris because he played on his football team. And I mean, he was just kind of the center of his own universe. So anyway, I met a lot of people at his house. Then we go bar hopping. We went to like 6 or 8 different clubs and bars. I got super wasted.
Welcome to Shanghai.
He found me a job like within like 4 hours of being here. He's like, what do you want? I'm like, teach English. He's like, all right. Introduced me to like 3 or 4 different people.
Yeah, you can do that in your sleep in China.
Yeah, but to me at the time it was super impressive.
What?
Yeah, I'm like, this guy's so connected. Like, his beer belly does not lie. His true potential.
With teaching for you, was it like, that's just what I've heard is the easiest, or is that really
no,
the
well,
desire you had at the time?
I wanted to go teach English because I thought it would kind of be like a low stress job with flexible hours,
mm-hmm.
and my real goal was to do a lot of traveling.
Yeah,
and I figured that what I could do was like show up at this spot, teach a couple of classes for like a week or two, and then meander over here, yeah. and then you know teach. It didn't wind up being like that. Like Shanghai sucked me in pretty strongly yeah. when I got here, and I wound up taking a contract for a year at a place and working more than I intended, but getting paid well for the time yeah. that I was working. And I got to travel kind of in the immediate area around Shanghai, but I really didn't leave, like, the Suzhou, Hangzhou, Nanjing, mm-hmm. Ningbo circuit until I started traveling for work for my yeah. next job. And now I've had the good fortune to kind of go all over Asia, but it took a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was starting up process?
Oh, fuck, man.
Yeah. I want to hear about it, because I hear we had a previous guest who started a few companies, but no... brick and mortar seems to be a very difficult move here.
Starting a business here, any business, mm-hmm. as a foreigner, is in itself an undertaking.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much red tape, there is so much bureaucracy, you have to have a lawyer mm-hmm. who knows how to do this shit in yeah. order to go into it. You cannot get by on your own with like a Chinese friend going yeah. to different bureaus with you. Like, now you have to read this pile of shit and sign it and understand it. So, I mean, it's expensive, it takes a lot of time, and it is a fucking headache. Yeah. That's just a business. Now, if you want to actually have a physical location, there's yeah. a whole other layer on top of it of dealing with licenses, dealing with inspections, paying off the right people, purchasing, like, a pre-existing license from somebody, or applying for a new license in a location, which is next to impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Then, on top of that, there is the universal fact that no matter where you are, starting and running and maintaining an F&B business is among the most difficult businesses mm-hmm. to run. I mean,
yeah,
it is a fucking nightmare dealing with customers, dealing with staff, dealing with the workload, the hours. I mean, it's just really, really draining. So you combine all those things at once. I will say this. Having successfully started and run and having gone from no location to a partial brick and mortar to our own autonomous brick and mortar, it's taken a lot out of me.
Yeah.
But I also feel like at this point I can basically do anything. I don't feel like there's
any.
Feel
no pain anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Like barring like training as an astronaut and going to the moon, like I'm pretty sure I have shit handled. So I'm currently looking around for work right now, which unfortunately I'm really, really, really picky, and there hasn't been anything that I've found that either pays what I'm looking for or is in a field I'm interested in.
Yeah.
So I've largely been unemployed since we shut the restaurant.
But you're still DJing pretty regularly.
I'm DJing regularly, but I, again, like I said earlier, I learned my lesson about that. I will never let that be my bread earner.
Huh.
Like, it's a great hobby, and for me, it's an emotional outlet. It's a way to blow off steam. It's a way to do something that I really enjoy, express myself creatively. But I will never let myself play more than four to, like, let's say six times maximum per month.
Just takes the fun out of it.
It does. It does. It has to be. And the great thing about my DJ career versus a lot of other people's is I can dictate the terms. So I can pick and choose where I play, when I play, what I play, how I play, to whom I play. And I have complete power to pick and choose what I do. And that's how I like it. So I never want to sacrifice that.
So as of, I mean, as of last year, you were DJing and running the restaurant.
Yeah.
How are you doing that? I mean, it must have been exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very exhausting.
You were commuting all the way out to the mansion.
Yeah. I think that I had to DJ in order to remain sane enough to stay committed to the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it was a way to blow off steam. It was a way to be, to have a life separate from the restaurant.
It could, you could for a little bit separate yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, music is aural emotion. It is literally waves of emotion that are being transmitted across space. So I could take any of the stress or fatigue or any negativity that I was feeling from a work week, go out to a gig, play my heart out, and it was like therapy, you know? And my sets would reflect that. They'd start off really hard and driving, and by the end, as I'm feeling better, they would get like really happy and like, yeah. So, yeah, I think that that was, even though it was quote unquote more work, I think that it was necessary to enable myself to do the main job.
We have a few other stories on the list that I would like to hear. So before we run out of time, the Porsche and the Berlin Rave.
Right.
I would like to hear about.
Okay. So, as I said, I was the business development manager for this big Chinese company, and, they would send me to these business conferences, one of which was in Berlin, Germany. And so I went out there, and I, you know, being a Detroit techno snob, I'm obsessed with Berlin, which was basically Detroit's sister city for techno. And, you know, so many of my favorite artists operate out of Berlin, and I was just so excited to go there. And I at this time, I was already planning on leaving the BD job to start the restaurant with Matt. I did not want to rub anyone the wrong way, and I wanted to remain professional. And so I was forthcoming with my employers about my intentions. I said, I want to start this restaurant. I want to phase myself out. I don't want to leave you high and dry. So let's together find somebody that we think can replace me. I'll train them. And when the time is right, I'll stop and they can take everything over.
So is it a pretty small company?
No, no, they're quite large. Okay. They have like, I don't know, 7,000 or 8,000 employees across the country. But I was the only foreigner working for them, who wasn't a teacher. So, and they were like, okay, you know, that's weird because normally you would just quit, but okay, fine. and we had since recruited this guy who's a good candidate. And so we decided he was going to come on this trip with me so he could see how I would operate and how to talk to people and how to present our material.
And foreign guy or local guy?
He's from Texas.
Okay.
Yeah. Good Chinese, though. So so it was actually, the conference was
over like a weekend, but it was his birthday like 2 days before that. And so I went to my boss and I'm like, hey, it's going to be his birthday. You know, I think it would be a warm welcome for this guy. If it, you know, let's just send me there a little bit early with him and we'll have his birthday there. And, you know, and it gives us time to get over the jet lag. And nice. I didn't give a fuck about this guy's birthday. I just wanted to hang out in the lake.
Yeah.
But it worked. We sold it. So, we actually wound up going 4 days before the conference. so we had some time to ourselves and like, we went like drinking and whoring and like, yeah, just had a great time. The only thing was, A, it was the middle of the week when we got there, and B, the true to form, we really were jet lagged the first 24 hours, so just slept my first night. Second night, I think we just went to the bar and like, went around the city looking at, like, the wall and other dumb shit. the third day was his birthday, and so I'm like, all right, dude, we're going to do some cool shit for your birthday, and we were in the Swiss Hotel. Right next to the Swiss Hotel, I had seen there was a car rental agency, and they were advertising a Porsche 911 Carrera S for 24 hours for 200 euros. And I was like, fuck yes. Not only is driving on the Autobahn on my bucket list, but fucking, my the Porsche?
And Carrera?
Like, I was so stoked. I like knew this guy was going to be stoked. And my plan was I was going to drive us to Amsterdam. From Berlin, which it, you can do that in a Porsche. And I was like, we're going to go party in Amsterdam. It's going to be crazy. And he was unfortunately not super up for it. But I convinced him to at least drive on the Autobahn.
You're like, get on my little. Get on my little.
Yeah. So like,
get in, bitch. We're going shopping.
Yeah. Right. Basically. Yeah. So like we go out. We're like flying. I have video somewhere. I'll send it to you of us. Doing like 295 kilometers per hour down the Autobahn, just like passing shit like it's standing still.
Yeah.
Time of our lives type of shit. I go one way, and then, you know, he turns around and he takes us back. And we're all pretty amped up, and like we go out for like, I take him for like a nice dinner, and we go to the bar, and then we go and we meet some guys at the bar. And, you know, I'm chatting them up because this whole time I've had my feelers out. I'm like, you know, where the fuck, you know, like, I mean, there's like Bergheim and there's Trezor and there's like these established clubs, but I want like the true underground, like Berlin party scene. And I'm like, we meet these guys at the bar that seem to know what's going on. Right. And they're like, oh yeah, we will take you to East Berlin and we will be having a great party. And I'm like, oh yeah, fuck yeah, this is exciting. Let's do it. And this, I cannot get this guy excited about anything. Yeah. He's like, I just want to get drunk and, you know, go to sleep. I'm like, fuck, man. So, like, we put him back in the hotel. And I'm like, all right, boys, where's the party? And they're like, yeah, it will not be starting for some time. So let us go and maybe be having some relations. And I'm like, okay. So, like, we go to this, like, brothel. And I wind up, like, banging this, like, really, really hot, but I think probably regularly beaten chick from East Ukraine. And then, like, that was kind of sketchy. And then, like, we had some drinks there. And it was getting around, like, I don't know, like, 12:30 or 1 in the morning. They're like, yeah, now is his time, so we can go to the party. And so, like, we all pile into the Porsche and go way, 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 way into East Berlin in, like, the middle of nowhere. It's, like, nondescript suburbia. Mm-hmm. Like, we're literally just driving through a neighborhood, and they're like, yeah, this is the place. And I'm like, we go into your mom's basement? Like, what the fuck? And then I realized the intersection that we're stopped at, there's no traffic light. It's a disco ball. And there's, like, lasers bouncing off of it, but they're green and red lasers. So, like, from a distance, I thought it was, like, the traffic light. And then I'm, like, looking around, and it's four blocks in the middle of this suburb that have been converted into, like, a multi-building club. Like, the only way I can describe it is it's a cluburb. Okay? Where, like, every building on
like
the Burning block...
Man. Like, they built a...
No, no, but it was just... Village. Like, it was part of the neighborhood that they just, like, blocked off. Yeah. They're like, now it's a club.
Michigan Fairgrounds.
Yes, Michigan State Fairgrounds, man. Catalina Wine Mixer, Boats and Hoes.
So like, and they're like, yeah, you can park
like,
over
we're here.
Here.
It's not like, no, we're here. We're
yeah,
inside like
this,
of it now.
Yeah, yeah, you've driven into the club. And like, I just park on the lawn somewhere. And like, every single house and building and like shop that we pass, like you open the door and there's a DJ inside playing music and there's people dancing. Oh, every single one. It's fucking crazy. And like, you walk down the sidewalk and there's like, a fucking tractor trailer with like some weird Germans
just
with like sparkly
South
face
Southwest
paint selling hot dogs. And like, yeah, it was like, it was, yeah, totally. It was just, it was so surreal. And they're like, yeah, now people eat the ecstasy. And like, they give me some meat. And I'm like, okay. And like, all of a sudden I'm in this fucking haze. And like, we're going from building to building, listening to like some of the most amazing, just pure deep house and deep techno. And like, and it's like, you know how the Germans are about everything, like, you know, they're so proper and, like, almost sterile, and, like, I have never been to, like, a better-mannered party in my entire life. Like, everyone is, like, very respectfully dancing to the music.
This is like how the sprockets would be done.
Yeah, totally. Like, I'm expecting someone to come out with a fucking monkey. Like, it was like that.
Watch my monkey.
And, like, and like, it's, like, everyone's super respectful of the DJ. No one's getting into fistfights. Like, okay, I told you that I go off on tangents. The first rave I ever went to in my life was under the Ambassador Bridge in Detroit, which is like the old school rave spot, mm-hmm. right? It was a proper, completely illegal, underground fucking rave. And we do a bunch of fucking mushrooms and ecstasy before we get in the car to go there. And it's all kicking in as we come into the parking lot. Get out of the car. Mushrooms are kicking in. It's a super like terrifying atmosphere, because like this part of Detroit is a bad part of Detroit, which is bad, and then you have like the extra bad part where it's like that building is still burning and has been since 1968, and like, oh, there's like that guy's blood on the sidewalk from where he got shot last week, and like, I mean, it's just, it's like RoboCop, like it's bad. And so like, we're getting out, the mushrooms are,
it's bad. RoboCop, bad.
Yeah, that's bad.
This is RoboCop Detroit we're talking about.
Yeah, which was set in Detroit for a reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they cleaned it up a little bit for that movie, actually. But, like, okay, we get out of the car, and mushrooms are kicking in. I'm just driven through, like, the sketchiest neighborhood of all time. And I'm just like, holy shit, dude, this is a bad idea, this is a bad idea. My friends are, like, trying to talk me down. It's going to be fine, it's going to be fine. Look. Look, we're in good company. There's, like, candy kids going by with, like, blinking pacifiers and, like, candy up to here and fat pants that, like, could house, like, a small nation's refugees. And, you know, like, they're like, yeah, let's go party. And I'm like, okay, maybe everything's okay. Maybe I'm fine. It's cool. And we're like, you know, I'm starting to calm down. And, like, some guy was like, hey, I'm parked in. I can't get to my car. And there was, like, some, like, Volkswagen Beetle blocking it. And, like, a group comes over and, like, shifts it over on, like, the gravel so we can get out. And I'm like, oh, community! Like, yay! And I'm starting to
we're
call them.
Friends.
Yeah. And we're in line, and, like, I'm starting to feel good, and I can hear the bass coming out of the warehouse, and, like, the ecstasy starting to take over the mushrooms. And I'm like, all right, maybe this is going to be okay. Maybe this is going to be okay. And all of a sudden, as we're getting up to the front of the line, the door to the warehouse bangs open, and a giant security guard comes out clutching his side. There's just blood streaming from between his fingers. He's like, that motherfucker stabbed me! Where's my piece? Someone get my gun, man! And, like, fucking, he just stumbles off into the darkness. And then, like, three other security guards come out holding some guy. And he, like, drops a knife. And they start beating the shit out of him right in front of the door. Like, stomping the shit out of him. Like, teeth are flying. Like, he's just a fucking mangled mess. And I'm just like, oh my god, oh my god. Like, completely, like, at this point, full-on bad trip. Just, oh, fuck. And, like, and
you're a teenager, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, dude, no.
19, you know, when he was having a good year.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, abort, mayday, bad, no. And my friends are like, no, it's Detroit, man, it's cool. And, like, we just, they, like, fucking drag me inside. I actually wound up having a really good time. But, like, that was, like, my introduction to, like, the Detroit rave scene. It's just, like, standard. Like, you leave the club, you watch a drive-by shooting, and you go home. Like, it's that kind of thing. Like, seriously, like, it's fucked up. So, going from that kind of atmosphere to Berlin, where it's, like, you know, like, everyone is just, like, kind of well-kempt. Like, they're ravers, but they're, you know, clean-cut ravers. And they're clearly just enjoying the shit out of the music, and half of them probably aren't on drugs. And, like, and then I thought for sure, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm like, dude, no, no one's gonna fight. Like, no one's like, this is all free love, really? You know, I'm like, my guard's up and shit. Like, and one of the guys I'm with who had been, you know, kind of like the alpha male of his group, yeah. We're like hanging out dancing, and he's like, oh, look at this faggot. And I'm like, oh man, like, what? And there's like some really tall dude, like, with like some glitter on his face and stuff. He's like, watch out for him, he probably wants to suck your schwanz or whatever. And like, I'm like, okay, are we about to, like, is shit about to go down right now? And the guy like walks up and he's like, get out of here, faggot. And the guy's like, no, just let me apply this glitter to your forehead. And he's like, fine, this one time is okay, you silly faggot. And so, like, and apparently they knew each other.
Your friends?
Yeah, and, like, they knew each other, and the guy really is gay, but, like, he just likes, the other guy just likes to give him shit. So the dude, like, put glitter all over his forehead, and then he, like, put glitter all over me, and then, like, we're just, like, dancing around all glittery, and, like, it was great. Like, I finally realized, like, it's okay. Like, these are all, like, really nice, just happy people having a really good time. And I had a fucking blast. And I'm, like, going from building to building, and I'm just like, what's in this door? Oh, it's more good music. Oh, boy. And, like, it was like, I was like a kid in a fucking candy store. And this goes on and on. And then all of a sudden I realized, like, it's light out. And it's been light out for, like, quite some time. I finally, like, get to someone to check the time. My phone has died. And, it's like, I don't know, 10:30 or something.
Oh,
like
my that, God.
In the morning. And I had rented the Porsche at, like, 11 the previous day. It was 24 hours. And I'm like, fuck! It was like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where I'm like, fuck, I gotta get, you know, I gotta beat the clock. And I'm like, run out of there. I say bye to everybody. I run out. I jump in the Porsche. Floor it through town. Excuse me. Get back to the dealership. It's like, you know, 30 seconds on the clock, yeah. Like, slow motion Chariots of Fire. Running through the fucking door with the keys like, Arvgarder. And I get in, and I'm handing the keys over, and I'm like, why is everyone staring at me? And then I realize that I am covered in, like, a layer of the night's party scum. I have fucking glitter all over my forehead, and I smell like a distillery from all the fucking booze that we've been drinking. And so I'm like, hey, oh. And I hand over the keys, and they're like, you know, is the car okay? And I'm like, no, the car's fine. And they clearly have this, like, yeah, fucking right expression on their face. And they go out, and they're gone for a super long time. And, like, other people at the agency have, like, moved to block the doors so I can't escape. And I'm just like, dude, am I going to jail? Like, oh, shit, like, this was such a good night. How did this go wrong so quickly? Then the person comes back in, and they're, like, so shocked. And they're like, yeah, the car's fine. And, okay, thank you. Like, you know, here's your deposit back.
You're just a danger to yourself.
Yeah, and they're just so confused, because I'm clearly, like, my pupils are, like, the size of teacups. And I'm just like, it was really fun. I had a great time. I love the Autobahn. Germany sure is a great country. And they're just like, what the fuck is going on right now? So,
it's a fun automobile.
Yeah. So, like, and they take the keys back, and I'm like, man, that was really good. Do you think I could do that again? And they're like, oh, no. Like, it has been rented. And they're, like, ripping the sign out of the window, and they're like, you need to go back to your hotel now. And I'm like, okay, and, like, just go back. So that was the Porsche and the Berlin.
What happened to the other kid you were with?
He was sleeping in the hotel the whole time.
The entire time?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was, like, I got back at, like, 11 in the morning, and he got drunk and went home at, like, 12:30 or something. So he was, like, waking up hungover, like, and I'm just sitting there, like, hey, how you doing, man? Did you have a good night? I had a good night.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday, buddy. You want a massage? So, like, So then he was fine, like, working off a minor hangover, and then I just crashed off of all this shit that I'd done, and I was, like, catatonic from that. We had, like, 72 hours, and, like, the first 56 of them, I was, like, dead to the world, to the point where he's like, dude, are you alive? Like, we have to go to this conference, you have to show me what's happening.
May
have
a comment.
Yeah, and I'm like, give me my time, like, we got this.
That's amazing.
I think that's a pretty good place to end. Nate, thank you for coming.
So happy to be here.
Of course, telling plenty of great stories.
That was amazing. For someone who has such extreme life experiences, thank you for being a real dude.
And, we'll have to do a volume 2 to get some of these other stories.
I've got plenty more where those came from, for sure. All right, cool. Thanks, guys.